Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Mays, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Rich Murphy, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing for striped bass. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Rich a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of the questions as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Rich Murphy about fly fishing for striped bass. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California, features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department, and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keene.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. Before we introduce Rich, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 1-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Rich's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Rich Murphy's book, Fly Fishing for Stripers, courtesy of Wild River Press. And here's how you can win that book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something we talk about during the show. And you must submit your answer along with your name and your location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills and be fast about it, and maybe you'll win Rich's book. Well, tonight our guest is Rich Murphy. Rich Murphy is a professional civil engineer in Massachusetts, a published author and a professional fly designer, and a saltwater fly fishing junkie. Murphy taught himself to fly, cast, and tie simple freshwater flies over the winter of his 8th year. He caught his first trout on a fly that next spring using a mayfly spinner pattern copied from an old Field and Stream. He started tying saltwater flies commercially over 20 years ago. In the winter of 1995, Murphy entered a fly designing contract with Umpqua Feather Merchants, and to date, Umpqua has accepted 8 of his fly patterns for their catalog. The Konomo Special, Steep Hill Special, RM Short Fin Squid, RM Flatside, RM Needlefish, RM Rattlesnake, RM Spitfire, and the Tamit Special. Murphy has written feature articles for fly fishing periodicals that include Saltwater Fly Fishing, Fish and Fly Magazine, and Fly Tire. His book, Fly Fishing for Striped Bass, went to print in July of 2007 and is presently available in most major retail and internet book retail outlets. Rich, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hey, how are you doing there?
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I thought you read that little bio. They're pretty good.
Sounded good about yourself, huh?
Yeah, sometimes I forget. I need to be reminded, right?
Yeah. Well, got lots to talk about here tonight, and lots of questions came in, so I'm excited about that. It's always nice to have our listeners submit so many questions, and it looks like we'll have a full show here on those questions. So let's get started. Can you tell us, just to get going here, Rich, a little bit about the background of the striper and, you know, kind of how it lives its life?
Well, you know, stripers are, we want to back up to something like when stripers begin to come online, it's like a life, as a distinct species of life form, be at the end of the last glaciation of Wisconsin. It's like something like 4,000 years ago, and maybe back when they were something like a perch-like form, and basic environment was a freshwater one. But then, as the glaciers retreated and sea levels started to rise, inevitably that their environment where they lived was immersed in salt water. So as a, just as a matter of adaptation, they became they had to really adapt to be in a marine environment. And then as lands continued to subside, as the glaciers retreated further, they became predominantly a, at least on the East Coast, they became a well-adapted to fastly living in both environments, in like a fresh and salt water. Right now, striped bass populations on the East Coast are dominated by a fish that breed and spawn within the Chesapeake Bay. There are like, let's see, besides Chesapeake, there's Albemarle Bay moving up in Chesapeake, Delaware Bay, Hudson Bay, Hudson River. Those Hudson River, probably those three, back up, the three main population centers are Chesapeake Bay, Albemarle Bay, Albemarle Sound, check that, and the Hudson River. But like hands down, by maybe two orders of magnitude, the most significant source of striped bass on the East Coast is the Chesapeake Bay. So going on to like just a brief bit about like migratory habits.
Yeah. Let's talk about how they get from Chesapeake up to your part of the.
Let's visualize that there's like a center of mass of striped bass live a particular year on the East Coast. That center of mass, a population of migratory wild striped bass that move up and down the eastern seaboard. Predominantly, the fish that move up and down the seaboard are females, and the females predominantly are from Chesapeake Bay. I know this for sure because I've done a bit of work with Mass Division of Marine Fisheries between 1997 and 2001, in which something like 5,000 stripers were harvested, the contents of their stomachs dissected, and you know that information was collated and so forth. But one bit that I did get out of that, my participation in that was, well, I had to kill a lot of stripers for, I'm not proud of it, but I did gain a lot of information about it. One bit about it, was that just from looking at the genetic imprints of the fish that were harvested, was that over 90% of them came from the Chesapeake Bay, and of them, sex-wise, 85% were female. So what that tells me is that if there's a population standard of fish moving up and down the eastern seaboard, they're females. They're from the Chesapeake Bay. Probably age-wise, between, I would say a few years ago, between 3 years and up to 25 years. Stripers are relatively long-lived fish species. I mean, they're fairly unique along that line. Migratory habits, let's pick up the pace there. Migratory habits is that the stripers, the population of females I'm talking about, and these could be like up, up to 40-pound stripers. I mean, the major ones that we'll see coming up and down here, that anglers will have a shot at, probably anywhere on the eastern seaboard that's outside of the bay. That population doesn't spend a whole lot of time in the bay itself. If they will overwinter somewhere off the coast of North Carolina's Outer Banks, they won't go too much further south than the point of than Cape Hatteras, because they'll be getting into the Gulf Stream waters, which are unacceptably warm to them. Overwinter there, they'll move north, enter the bay, spawn somewhere in the early April, and then after they spawn, they leave the bay. They do not linger there. They'll move further north. They'll follow an isotherm of about 50 degrees as the water warms up. The rate at which they move, gee whiz. Most years, I think my computer is something like 16 miles per day, but that adds up. So if they spawn, say, April 10th down in the bay, I'd expect like the same mature females to arrive up my way, which is about, that far, something like 750 miles. When? The last week of, maybe the first week of June, something like that. They will the objective of their movement is to, after overwintering, they spawn, they move north. They'll stay in an area close to my home. And then as the water begins to cool in the fall, they'll move south. The reason why the fish, this female population, moves to the north is pretty simple. It's like a biological imperative. in the biological imperative there, it's important for the females to grow and to get very large. And that has to do with the reproductive process, okay? They're a longer fish, so in some years their spawn is like adversely affected by outside environmental impact. Sometimes it's not. But it's important that in order to ensure like a successful year class in any particular year, that millions and millions of eggs are introduced to the spawn to get fertilized. And the kicker to that is that a young female, say, going into a first spawn at age 5, might only bear, say, 10,000 eggs, 50,000 eggs. Female, if she increases her weight to 20 pounds, she gets that up to, like, say, 5 million eggs. And then a 40-pounder, I'm not real sure I have a real clear statistics on that, but, you know, it could be something like 40 million eggs. And if all of them get fertilized, then that kind of assures that you're going to have, like, well, depending on the number of females that come back, that's always a wild card as well.
Okay, so we've got them migrating up from Chesapeake. How old? You said they get rather old. What's an old striper?
An old striper, well, I think the oldest one in captivity is something like 28 years.
28 years. And how big, you said, 40-pound stripers? Is a 40-pounder a trophy? Or is
I don't know. I've been like at this game for so long, it's hard for me to, like, right now, it's hard for me to visualize even getting a striper out of the water. But trophy size, I don't know. You know, it's, gee whiz. Something over 20 pounds is something to be proud of. I think you catch a big striper like that, and you get it close enough to you, say, it's big, and then just pop a leader and let it go. I'd say that was the right thing to do. As far as, like, capturing a striper right now, I think the species in general is kind of in peril, but just mindlessly harvest a striper just for the sake of a trophy is probably not.
Yeah, no, I was just talking about size. I was just talking about size, Rich, more than anything else, not killing fish.
Size-wise, I think you get a striper over 20 pounds, you know, you got a handful.
Okay. So they migrate up, and about the farthest south is North Carolina, and then is the furthest north Massachusetts?
Oh, no. The reason why the females are moving north is to remain, they're cold-blooded species. So they work particularly well in a characteristic band of temperature. For stripers, that band is like, it's centered where they work the best at about 65 degrees, water temperature 65 degrees. And fortunately, if you went to, Rutgers University, their laboratory of coastal observation, and looked at some of their satellite imagery, it's like Landsat imagery for like sea surface temperatures. That's part of my book there. You know, you'd see that seasonally, that the temperature up my way, this is in northern Massachusetts, say by June 10th, water temperatures offshore warm up to 65 degrees, which is not all that warm at all. But by June 10th, 65 degrees, July 4th, 65 degrees, August 28th, 65 degrees, September 1st, 65 degrees. Most years by October 25th, 65 degrees. So up my way is where striper migration, the migration of wild stripers, it makes sense that this would be a logical terminus for them to stop and pause, like forage over the course of a summer.
Okay. So they kind of hang in there all summer. Okay, good.
You know, I do believe, you know, again, we're talking about center mass of fish, and because there's so many that, you know, the behavior of individual fish or individual schools is going to vary dramatically. And some fish, of course, on any given year, they could migrate way far north, further north, maybe up as far as Canada, way up towards the Bay of Fundy.
Okay.
That potentially could happen, but I would say in general that the center of mass kind of reaches, gets around Cape Cod and settles in somewhere between, say, the tip of Cape Ann and, like, southern Maine.
Okay. For the summer. Okay, we got another question from Paul in California. He wants to know if there's any significant differences between the behavior between East and West Coast stripers.
Well, first of all, stripers are native to the East Coast. And then, 1878 or something like that. This is after the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad. Weirdly enough, one of the first activities it was engaged in, most important one, was transferring fish species, rainbow trout from the west coast to the east coast, and then stripers from the east coast to the west coast. Those are the first big deals that I'm aware of that actually went down behind that operation. I think the stripers were introduced to San Francisco Bay. We were in San Francisco Bay, I think, 1878, something like that. And I do believe, it was like a real small number of fish, like maybe 100 fish were introduced, and that stocking was like backed up maybe 2 years later with maybe 200 more. But once the stripers were introduced, San Francisco to the northern end of the bay itself, but their populations found the conditions there at that time ideal, and the populations exploded. Okay, that being said, the differences in behavior probably would have more to do with just the confinement of migratory habits of the fish on the West Coast.
So basically, you're telling me that the fish on the West Coast were not native, and they were brought in and stocked.
Right. And I would say that very few of the fish right now, this is now, not back when, say, even 40 years ago or so. I would say right now that the fish in the West Coast, the populations are dominated by fish living in San Francisco Bay, getting up in the Sacramento River Delta and so forth. I don't think many of those fish actually leave San Francisco Bay and make extensive migrations up and down the Pacific coastline. Their lifespans are spent pretty much within the confines of the bay.
Yeah. And so we've got, as far as behavior goes, we're probably looking at pretty similar behavior, just probably fishing them in a very similar way that you would on the East Coast.
Well, I think primarily you'd be fishing in an environment that was basically estuarine. You wouldn't be looking to fish for them in an open surf environment, open beach, or exposed rocks, except for, at the entrance to the bay itself. And, you got to remember, Russell Chatham caught a world record striper win in 1968, and that was at the Point Reyes Bridge, and that was towards the mouth of, towards the entrance of the harbor itself. But again, I would say that environment it would be like an estuarine type of environment. There wasn't a whole lot of surfing, but probably really strong tidal currents.
What's the status of the population of striped bass on the eastern seaboard? Is it thriving? Is it declining?
I would say no. I think that there are problems with it. The year class returns from the Maryland Department of Public, Maryland, that was the DNR, Department of Natural Resources, they've been maintaining a juvenile striper index now since 1954. And the index is developed. It's a geometric mean of stripers caught per haul of seine nets, stations that are established within territorial waters of Maryland. And it's visualize you have a group of biologists. They set up at a site that they've been doing the same operation at for many, many years. They'll set up a pristine net. And they'll try to capture, they'll follow a procedure as close as they can to capture juvenile stripers and then simply count how many they got. And that's what the index is. The index, see, the average index, this is like a geometric catch. I mean, the number itself is I'm trying to explain what the number is, but it has to be, it's the context of the number that's more important. If the juvenile index is 3.4, that's about average. That's the average mean catch per haul in them nets. Lately, I would say over the last 5 years, that juvenile index has been less than one, which does not bode well. I'm looking back at gee whiz, if my memory serves me very well, juvenile index.
Okay, so basically,
the juvenile index has been down. It's been down for a significant time now, maybe 5 years. Which tells you that if it takes 5 years for stripers or 4 years for stripers to a striper female to mature from yearling to a viable female for a spawn, it's almost it's pretty clear that the breeding population of stripers may well be in jeopardy right now.
Okay. We had another question about the status of getting striped bass listed as a game fish and eliminating them from commercial fishing. Is anything like that in the works?
I don't think so, because the industry for commercial fishing industry for stripers is something that's very well established. And stripers are managed right now as a commercial species. And, you know, with that commercial interest in place, probably, you know, I can't see that changing in the foreseeable future.
Okay.
As again, I'm getting back to population dynamics. I'm saying that population dynamics, for me, in the within the short term, are looking at diminishing returns.
Yeah.
And
I
can't see that changing any time in the future.
Okay.
And, I think that
we need to take a quick break here, Rich. And when we come back, let's talk about where and when we should be catching stripers. So, when we return, we'll be talking more with Rich about fly fishing for striped bass. Our approach is simple: education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like short line nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all that you need to know about fly fishing. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Rich Murphy about fly fishing for striped bass. If you'd like to ask Rich a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Rich, I want to take just a minute here before we jump back into the questions and ask you, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? I know you published your book here a couple of years ago. What else is happening?
It was, I think, maybe a big push that I would make is to encourage anglers like saltwater anglers on the East Coast to register themselves, you know, with state agencies, you know, to pay their register and get licenses and provide information as best you can as to the fish that you harvest, to like improve the database that the fisheries management guys are working with. In general, the folks who manage the stocks are relying on returns from tag returns from commercial outfits to develop a sense of, like, you know, the vitality of the female breeding population. And I think that's kind of skewed. That information bit, that whole information bit, is distinctly skewed. And it's important that the East Coast anglers stripers provide that information to the resource people so that they can make better judgments as to how the stock should be managed. That's about it. I mean, that.
So that's something you're very passionate about, it sounds like, and would like some help there with that
documentation. I think it's important that recreational anglers do their bit to provide information to the folks who actually manage the fisheries. And that probably would have that cumulative effort to find that extra information could be critical in terms of, like, the formation of or their revision of their predictive models and perhaps of how the species is managed in the future.
Okay. Well, we've got a couple questions about where and when here. We got Charles in New York. He says he's going up to Maine, Bar Harbor area, in early August and would like to know if you think stripers will be available up there.
Yeah, definitely early August. I mean, stripers, if they're going to, I would say for sure there would be stripers that far north. It also suggests that stripers you might interface with up there may well be on relatively large size as well.
Good.
All right, so migration, the tip of any given migration is probably the front line of it, are probably very big females.
Right,
and, The females are probably following very schools of large Atlantic menhaden. One that we didn't get into by way of the striper migration is that the migration of Atlantic menhaden and striped bass in the East Coast, they are intrinsically tied, and that the both species migrate north at about the same time. Atlantic menhaden, they're not an adverse, they spawn offshore as they migrate. The Atlantic menhaden, they break down the schools by age class because they move at a particular rate, and it's critical that they stay together, maintain as large schools as possible, improve their odds of survival when they're attacked. But moving north, the largest Atlantic menhaden go furthest north, and just as a general rule, a good number of the largest stripers fall. So Bar Harbor, Yeah, I'd say look for big fish there, and look for them around the rock structure there. Rock structures are fishing them. You don't have to cast very far, because the stripers may well be, like, as you come to a rock and a drop off, they may be right in front of you. And basically,
okay, we got another question here from Tommy in Boston. He says, where and when do you suggest to fish Cape Cod?
My prejudice there is like fish it when there aren't a whole lot of people out there vacationing. Which is, you know, it's probably fair advice. Good time would be up until, let's say, the summer solstice. But when the water's in the Cape, especially on the south side of the Cape, they'll warm up to the degree that stripers aren't really prolific inshore except at night. On the lower Cape, that is to say, further to the east, that rule kind of applies as well, in that stripers will be accessible throughout the high summer, mostly at night. Your best times to fish the Cape probably would be around, say, from Memorial, say from May 15th up to, say, June 30th, say mid-May to the end of June, and then again, but more, and maybe even better fishing would occur between, say, September 15th up to most years, say, the end of October.
Okay. Larry, who lives in Cape Cod, asks, when do you expect a worm hatch, and what is he talking about?
Well, a worm hatch involves a blood worm. It's a marine annelid. It's a worm that spends most of its life cycle as a burrowing within burrows. And then when the short-lived species, I think like 1 year or so, something like that, when they're ready to spawn, spawn will occur on like a spring tide, most likely in water temperatures, or, you know, it's temperature dependent. So the hatch could occur noontide in the months of May, June, July, and perhaps August. And what will happen on any one of those moon tides is that the ones that are ready to spawn, they'll kind of morph into like a burrowing kind of creature, into one that's somewhat enabled to have a limiting swimming potential. And the hatch will go down like just over the course of one tide cycle. And it's kind of simply a cluster F of worms at one point at one time. Again, look for them in warmer months. Top of a moon tide, probably within at the mouth of, say, a salt pond like that. That would be like, we'd have a real true concentration of them. We'd actually see them, that reproductive bit, go down as a bloom. Stripers, they love this, but for me, I'm kind of a little bit repulsed by it, because stripers are basically feeding on the individuals after they spawn. After the individual spawn, they die. So the stripers are eating dead stuff.
Do the fish get real active during this worm hatch then?
Yes. It's like for them, again, the objective, the reason why stripers come north in Jeopardy is to feed. It's easy to grow, to max out on their opportunities for growth. And that's like a golden opportunity for them. And there's absolutely no way, that they'll be inhibited about like not remaining within it. For as long as the opportunity persists.
Is there a particular fly that you have to do that, and is it a fishable situation for a fly?
Is it a fishable situation? You know, it's when you cast into a feeding event like that, you know, the fly that you present is going to be one piece of stuff within, like, millions of pieces of stuff. So you would probably, your best bet would be to fish around the periphery of it, or like either that would be on either horizontal side, or if possible below it. That way it would attract more attention. The fish right within the mass of things, it's just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
The odds are against it. You know, the odds are probably better that you'll snag a fish than that they'll, you know, center, focus on your fly and take it.
So is there any kind of a fly that, you know, replicates one of these worms and that you could fish along the edges with? Or would you be fishing more with an attractor pattern or, you know, bait fish pattern?
You know, I think the jury's out on that one. I think you might be better off like using the myriad of cinder worm type patterns, and that would be an archetypical one. May consist of like a bowl. Let's guess that the head is some kind of chenille colored black, and then you'd have a tail of marabou that was red, and that essentially would suffice.
Okay. We've got some other questions here getting into equipment and flies. Martin in Lawrence, Kansas asks, can you talk about gear needed when ocean wading for striped bass?
Let's start at the top. Rods, you know, in that kind of environment, you're wide open to intercepting with, you know, the very largest of striped bass. World record striped bass, Al McReynolds down in New Jersey in, she was 1978, Tony Stutzko in, 71, Nassau Beach down in New Orleans. And, Tony got his fish, open ocean beach. So he's a very deliberate fisherman. He knew what he was doing. He, narrowed down the odds. And, but the bit here is that, you know, if you're going to fish open ocean beaches, you have to be prepared to catch big fish and land them in a difficult surf condition. So you'll have not only the force of the fish work, you have to work against that, but also the force of the surf itself. So you can start off rod-wise with about, say, a 10-weight rod, 9-foot or 10-foot or something like that. Single-hander, that's cool. I myself use two-handers. I've been using two-handers now for about 6 years. And that makes, for me, it makes a whole lot more sense. But just getting down to something basic approach here. 10-weight rod, say 9, 10 feet long. Most likely you want to fish a full sinking head, maybe integrated head with a sinking line, running line integrated to a sinking head. The head maybe 30 feet long for that 10-weight, say 400 grains, something like that. There are many of those types of lines on the market. Leader-wise, leaders wouldn't necessarily have to be very long, say 7 feet, 8 feet, 9 feet, no longer than 10 feet. Probably want a fairly stiff leader type. If you want to break this down, say any further, say 4 feet, 60 pound test, say 2 feet, 50, and break that all the way down to something, say to tip it no less than 20 pounds. At night, it could be a different story. You might want to, it's important at night, especially in beach environments, any marine environment, fishing for stripers, to keep your fly up as high in the water column as you can. But there, on open ocean beach, the surf's always an element. So you'd have to use your discretion there. If the surf were really calm, then you may want to consider using a full floating line. If it were some degree of surf, maybe an intermediate. And then if the surf were really kind of breaking hard, you would probably want to stick to the sinking line itself.
So do you find that you use a full sinking line more often than the other two options?
Yeah, particularly in an open ocean environment, when I'm thinking of a Royal Cape, that's probably your best bet.
Okay.
To make an effective presentation.
Yeah.
Oftentimes,
the
presentation doesn't have to be a long one, but it has to be well-placed. It has to be intelligently placed. You have to keep your head up as to the movement of currents, nearby the beach and so forth. And if you can develop an eye for those types of current structures, then you realize that you can make very effective casts that are relatively short.
Well, we have a question that came in on the Internet that talks just to that. Sully in Melrose, Mass. He says, Rich, how far should I be able to cast for stripers in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, if I'm casting from the beach?
I'd say I think the distance you want to cast is intrinsically tied to the accuracy which you can the accuracy that you can deliver, and that's going to vary from individual to individual. With a single-handed rod, I would say that it would be kind of important that you develop skills using a double haul and salt and so forth, that you can deliver fly fish 75 feet straight ahead of you, plus or minus a couple of feet from where you're aiming at. And you want the fly to land. You don't want no slack in the line. So as soon as the fly lands, you're fishing. Maybe you might be even better advised to consider using or adapting yourself to using a two-handed, say, switch rod, which may allow you to cast further with an equivalent degree of accuracy. The important bit is when your fly hits the water, bang, there's no slack in your line and you're fishing. With a two-hander, there is there's no doubt that you could cast considerably further than you can with a single-hander.
Okay.
But then you get into issues of how much running line do you want to manage. With a two-hander, potentially you could cast overhead 150 feet, but then it may require you to recover 70 feet before you fly under tension and fishing.
How much backing do you put on your reel?
For stripers, they often run. For me, it would be very unusual for a striper to run more than, say, more than 250 feet, 300 feet in a single dedicated run. Very, very wide striper, they might be able to get that much line on you. An important bit is like when a striper starts to run, apply pressure to him right there and then, and to try to limit the distance of running. Getting back to the question, how much backing do you need? Get up minimum, say 200 yards.
Okay, are we going to need to take another break here, Rich? But when we come back, we'll talk more about gear and flies and strategies. So hang tight, folks. Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's fly fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Rich Murphy about fly fishing for striped bass. If you'd like to ask Rich a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Rich, got more questions here. When you were talking about the leaders and tippets, Don in Clarksville, Tennessee wanted to know specifically if there's any type of connector knots that you use when you're building your leaders and attaching your tippets?
Let's see. The tippet connection, the line systems I use are pretty uniform right now. Just getting to the leader itself, the connection between the leader and the line head, that connection, it's a loop-to-loop connection. Presumably there's a loop at the end of the front taper of your line and the loop connection between the leader there. That loop formed on the leader, I use a perfection knot. Pretty simple knot you can figure out how to do. Well, one thing I do that maybe most folks don't is I instead of like maintaining a real oval loop, I'll compress it so it's way more linear, and then maybe put a crimp at the very end of it, and maybe a crimp at the end of, corresponding crimp so that I can marry the two ends between the line end and the beginning of the leader. That connection is a real tight one. And then going down, I use blood knots. Say something, connection between, say, 60 and 50 pounds, a couple of turns is okay. But then you get down to, say, 40 or 30, you want a minimum of, like, 3 turns with blood knot. Finally, the connection between the tippet, whatever it is, and fly, probably use Lefty's Craze with the mono knot there, like that. So it would be like a kind of a loop-type knot to the fly.
A loop to the fly, okay.
Not a loop to loop. It would be like a loop. You'd form a loop-type knot. That would be the final connection between the leader and the fly.
Right. So that you have the fly has more free motion there to move, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And let's see, most of those. Larry in Cape Cod wants to know, what flies do you prefer, Clouser, Deceiver, or what other flies do you use that you've been successful with?
Flies, they've been, the way I approach a fly tying is like, let's say if for some reason another jig's up and I'm being exiled to a desert island and I can keep myself alive by fly fishing and I can have like 4 flies. Right? The 4 flies that I would bring with me, 2 of them would be focused on body type, the other would be on like the survivability of the pattern, and the other is kind of an oddball one. So the flies that typically I would use as I go out would be one that's shaped like it that would be in cross-section was kind of oval, and it's relative, as you look at it in a profile kind of perspective, its overall, height to length would be ratio of, say, 1 to 5. This would be like a herring-type migratory, herring-type bait. And those types of fish, herring-type fish, they're prolific in all oceans, planet-wide. You could probably find fossils of herring-type fish that look a lot like what we see right now coming up and down the East Coast that we call like bunker and so forth. The other type would be, rather than being elliptical in cross-section, they're more cylindrical. And the ratio of, say, the body height to its length would be extended, say, 1 to 7 to 1 to 10. The herring would be like 1 to 4, 1 to 5, something like that. So it would be like like sand eels or mullet. And again, the same body type of prey is like prolific planet-wise. What else? Another important fly type would be a fly, maybe you're mimicking something that's basically cylindrical in cross-section with a fairly long length, but tied on a keel-type hook. That is to say, a hook that's going to ride hook point up. And that's not necessarily a closet. But it's not a closet. It would be simply one that's riding hook point up. The important bit there is that if you've got fly in hand, that's probably going to be the last one you're going to lose. It's the one least likely to hang up on bottom structure. The clauses work, they do work terrific, but for my money, for me, there's like just too much danger, casting that clauser around. It's going to nick the tip of your rod, and you're going to, there it goes. I try to avoid using seriously weighted flies like that most of the time. Albeit, I get to admit that clauser is tied on, say, size one or less can be brutally effective.
So,
simply because I've broken too many rods using them.
Yeah.
But
can you name some flies that, give us some names of some commercial flies that people can go find somewhere?
Sure. I just want to get away. I definitely encourage you to, get all of my flies, of course. But, I would say, just objectively, in terms of, what's usable for casting, of course, they have my Panic Special, Dave Scholl's Mushmouth. What else? Uncle used to produce a keel-type fly. It was called the Seatoil Special. They don't anymore. I don't know why. Bob Popovic's...
Are you there?
What's that?
I lost you there for a second. You said Popovic's what?
Jiggy fly. Jiggy fly. Again, it's a fly that's going to run with the hook pointing up. Let's see what else. Real quick.
Well, you've got a lot of flies that you designed here that look outstanding in your book.
I want to get to one more important bit there is the use of, especially in the East Coast, the use of squid flies. Squid are in the same phylum as they're mollusks, same phylum as clams. But they're very, very intelligent and formidable predators. And they feed essentially on the same forage base as stripers do. That's to say, it could be you have an individual silverside moving along in its forage activity. And at the same time, a squid is vectoring on it to eat it, and stripers vectoring on the same prey to eat itself. And the confrontation would be, let's say, a short-fin squid no more than 7 inches long confronted by a 20-pound striper. All of a sudden, boom, striper's all over the squid. It's like a bit of an opportunity there. So it's important that when you go out to always carry the squid pattern.
We have a question come in on the Internet from Gary in Lafayette, Indiana, and he wants to know, do stripers take a fly or bait head-on like a largemouth bass, or do they come from behind and short-strike the fly?
No, the hit can come from below and behind.
Okay.
Most likely. Again, stripers are like brutally strong fish. They'll hold in very, very aggressive tidal currents, but they'll hold from behind structure. And if the water falls around the structure, there'd be like a point where the water itself has to its connection to the structure. It's like boundary layer separation, and stripers are going to be focusing on, boom, they're hitting anything that slips by there. Inevitably, that hit's going to come from below, and in general from behind.
Gary, too, same person asks from the on the internet here. Is there a particular color fly that stripers most frequently hit? White, chartreuse, silver?
I think you absolutely hit a nerve with chartreuse. Chartreuse is the last color in the visible spectrum that's finely attenuated of the water column. You've got to remember, when water hits the surface of the ocean, 80% of it is like reflected back off. 20% that actually gets through instantly is being attenuated, either by scattering, by absorption, like that. So even as you get down, say, 20 feet in relatively clear salt water, you're going to be losing colors, visible colors in the visible spectrum, very quickly. Chartreuse is a very last color in the visible spectrum that finally becomes obliterated within saltwater water column. So, you know, that means that your fly will, a chartreuse fly will be observable. It's like a phenomenon that's not necessarily perceived in striper's eye as something that's chartreuse, but something that contrasts against a background that's either lighter than it or darker than it, like over a distance away from the striper, horizontally or vertically as well, in terms of depth. Chartreuse is an important color, for sure.
Yeah, it seems to work freshwater, saltwater, all over the place. So, Kevin in Wilson, Wyoming. Kevin in Wilson, Wyoming wants to know, does weather and wind determine how and where you fish?
Well, that's a real generalized question.
I think maybe he's thinking, you know, does weather or wind push the fish in certain areas? Do they move based upon the weather? In a freshwater lake?
In general, the stripers will follow the bait. If your mass concentration is a bait, let's say an open ocean beach, let's say we're talking about a fall migration, and it happens to be a particularly strong one where there's a lot of bait moving towards the south, and maybe the winds for most of the migration that have been pushing them towards the south, the winds are predominating from, say, from the west or so forth. If the winds shift around to the east and all of a sudden the fish are pushed up against the shoreline, and even if the winds go in and start to howl then, if the wind is going to pin the bait up against the structure, however bad the wind is, that's where the fish are going to be.
Okay.
That's something to consider, like a wind that's going to confine bait that aren't powerful enough to resist the combined action of both the wind and surf, and they're going to be concentrated. Stripers will be there. Something to pay attention to.
Do you do most of your fishing from shore or from a boat?
I'm a pretty simple guy. Most of my fishing, hands down, is done from shore.
Oh, okay. Kevin, again, in Wilson, Wyoming, asks, could you offer some advice for a beginner shore beach fishermen on things to consider, you know, what to do to improve their odds of finding and attracting stripers?
What about that? I think the best bet, just if you're starting out there, the best bet for catching a striper would be not necessarily go to an open ocean beach, but to go to the mouth of an estuary, a point where a tidal creek or river enters the ocean itself, and maybe the best time to fish that would be on an outgoing tide. You've got to remember that on an incoming tide in an estuary situation, the water and the content and so forth, they're beginning to diverge throughout the system. That's to say that they're going away from some point of entry. But that reverses itself in the outgoing tide. Everything is converging to that one point where the estuary, the exit point, the outlet point, the estuary is the open ocean. That's where you want to be in the outgoing tide. So if you're just starting out, the mouth of an estuary or an estuary riverway, outgoing tide, that's where you want to be. In terms of you'd be considered using, you're most confident using, I guess, as a beginner. If you're confident using a full sinking line, that's cool. Intermediate line, that's cool. The most important bit is that you're comfortable with the rig, that don't get something you're completely unfamiliar with and expect it's going to work for you the first time out. First time out, use what you're familiar with. But
okay.
You've got to remember to minimum 8 weight, but you've got to remember that there is a distinct potential with your 8 weight there. You're going to hook into a fish that weighs 40 pounds.
Right. Now, you just described trying to find a place where fish are concentrated because of incoming or outgoing tides. Martin in Lawrence, Kansas asks, can you talk about what to watch for when ocean wading for striped bass? So, whether in that situation you just described or maybe an open beach, what are we looking for out there in the water to try to find the fish?
Well, a good indicator shorebirds. The shorebirds are they're out there for one reason, but the same reason the stripers are there. And, that's to feed on essentially the same prey the stripers do. Their behavior, where they're concentrated in mass, will probably give you a good handle as to where are the concentrations of bait fish, and also where are their concentrations of stripers. When you don't have shorebirds aloft, or they're simply sitting on the beach even as you walk by them, what you have to do is to cultivate an appreciation for how surf, as it impacts on the shoreline, as it recedes, you know, in which direction does it flow? You know, what kind of currents are prevalent right in front of you? Is there a prevalent longshore flow to the left or right of you, and so forth? It's a matter of cultivating an understanding or appreciation for the structures that develop along an open ocean beach. I mean, the open ocean beach is simply water coming up an inclined plane of the sand, and as it runs up, it runs back down, gets a bedload of sediment that carries back down. It collides with the next wave coming in. Inevitably, that the water that came in piles up, the sand will get dumped, and eventually that causes like a series of sandbars to develop just offshore, the shore you're fishing on. So over time and erosion, like structures will develop so that you'll have a deposition of sand, but there'll be a low point for the return of water to get back out into the ocean. They'll create like a hole where flow from either side of it will enter and then exit back out in the open ocean. Those types of structures, we observe like a current that's not necessarily coming in on you, but it's moving laterally to you. Those are important currents. Those are important things to consider and keep your eyes open for. And they're also the points where you can see distinctly where there's a difference in depth. It simply as you walk laterally along the shoreline, you will appreciate that, that here's a point that's deeper than a point, say, 50 feet to either side of it. You probably want to focus on the entrance current there as it moves laterally in front of your position as you look out to sea. And that would be a, kind of a critical place to fish. And that's a perfect place for stripers to wait, to hold an ambush. They can do that. They can stay beyond the force of surf that's going to be running up the beach face, the beach floor slope there. It recedes, and stripers go just beyond that, in that deeper zone, down deep, and just wait for prey, either pruning bait fish or in small crustaceans that are like native to the coastline there, simply to get scoured up and to be flushed out in, into that hole or pool, you know, prior to being the return water.
So it sounds, and this kind of maybe leads into a question from Joe from New Jersey. He asks, when approaching a new piece of beach or water, what type of fly and what section of the water column do you begin to search? So what I'm hearing is, actually, there along the coast, you almost have little, what we might think as rivers out there, and as we would read a Rocky Mountain River for holes and currents and stuff, you actually have that happening along the shore that you have to learn how to see and recognize. It's just not blind casting out there, right?
Well, you know, definitely don't want to get into blind casting. You start doing that, you'll find out very quickly the ocean is a very, very vast and empty place.
Yeah.
I look for, you know, in terms of like having like an organized structure of like riffle, pool, glide, you know, like orderly like that, you won't be quite as orderly as tidy as that. You know, you could expect to see open ocean beach to be as distinct as you at the top of the tide. Tide recedes, you'd notice as you started walking down to the beach, there was a distinct floor slope. There was a big break in the beach's slope. And then there might be a trough, but then seaward of that, there might be a sandbar, and then seaward of that might be another trough and another sandbar. And it's always useful before you fish a particular piece of open ocean beach to check it out at the very bottom of the tide, see how that structure works out. But it'll also tip you off as to, you know, where the depressions, the holes exist, and where the entrances are to them, and, you know, where the troughs exist, and, you know, the distance between the troughs, and then it's, you get a better handle on where the currents are the strongest. Where the currents are the strongest going into the holes are probably the best places you have your best opportunities.
Okay. Need to take a quick break again, and when we come back, we'll finish up with some strategies and techniques with Rich. So be right back. Pere Marquette River Lodge, a full-service Orvis-endorsed lodge, fly shop, and guide service, is located on the banks of the historic Pere Marquette River in Baldwin, Michigan. Pere Marquette River Lodge provides year-round lodging for the business or pleasure traveler as well as a full-service fly shop and guided trips for steelhead, salmon, and large resident brown trout. For more information, visit them at www.pmlodge.com. That's pmlodge.com. Or call them at 231-745-3972. 231-745-3972. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Rich Murphy about fly fishing for striped bass. If you'd like to ask Rich a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, we've got several questions here. Michael in Utah, Kevin in Wyoming, Martin, Kansas, all asking about types of retrieves and, you know, if there's anything special or how you do your retrieves.
Retrieving-wise, over time, the way that I do retrieves is to get my rod, and I'll tuck it into, let's see, my strong side casting would be on my right side, so I'd tuck the rod into my right side, retrieve with two hands, hand over hand, and it would definitely be using a stripping basket, especially like an open ocean beach. I don't care if you have a floating line, sinking, or an intermediate line, or whatever. Unless you're a real ace at storing that line in loops in your non-dominant hand, then you know you're going to get in trouble. So stripping baskets are probably something you get. It's an adaptation. It's not a difficult one, but it's an important one to make. So the retrieve would be hand over hand. And that gives you like a lot of flexibility. One, if you know, you can develop you know, pretty good retrieve at like a fairly decent velocity. You can also vary the tempo and or the syncopation of the you know, as well. It typically go back and think, how would you just do this to begin with? I'd probably make a long strip with my left hand, recover with my right, like that. So it'd be like a movement of a fly, like move, say, fairly briskly over foot, a pause. So it's important that bit of a syncopation, acceleration and then a pause, acceleration and a pause. That would give a stripe an opportunity to connect with a fly visually, you know, the visual contrast of the thing moving and then stopping and then moving again. I do believe visually they would respond to that, and I think mechanically in terms of the sound signal, it gives them something more distinct to respond to as well. But other strips, sometimes it's, especially if you happen to be offshore on a boat, and you want to use a pal of mine who's identified as speed of light stripping. In other words, you want to get your fly as deep as possible and then retrieve it as quickly as you could as well. And that, again, would be overhand, very, very long strokes to make your fly move very, very quickly. Sometimes that approach works really well. Sometimes the best approach is simply with a dead drift. But the key to it all, the most important bit altogether with any type of retrieve, is to always maintain contact with your fly. No slack in your line. No slack in your line. You get slack in your line, stripers could come up. Striper senses are key, or like a range such that the very last threshold that has to be passed, a test has to be passed before a striper will ingest anything, is that what does it taste like? What is it basically like that? Most spotted flies definitely don't taste like striper food, so as soon as they taste the thing, you're going to be splitting them out. And if you have any degree of slack in your line whatsoever, it could be that a striper makes contact, inhales your fly, spits it out, and you never knew that happened. So the most important bit of any retrieve is to make sure that you have zero slack in your line.
We have a question here. Eric from Pennsylvania asks, he says, if you do not see striped bass feeding, how long do you work a casting zone before moving on?
That would have a lot to do with your confidence that the water you were fishing over was holding fish. You know, if you would fished at a particular location and been successful before, probably I'd encourage you, like, remain there and fish, if you could, fish progressively. A search pattern might be that, let's back up. You come to, like, a piece of water that you know, you're not familiar with, and how long do you fish there? At a minimum, your first cast, your first swing, whatever, you want to keep it short, you know, go to your short game first, because you don't want to be making a long cast, have your line land, and then striping in the interim space. get spooked out and you say, wow, there's nothing here. First guess, it has to be a relatively short one. Retrieve, you probably want to give it like a, if it's 30, 40 feet, give it a couple of seconds to get down in the water, calm a bit, then start your retrieve. Again, a simple one, simply the retrieve is like make your fly move, say a foot pause, definite syncopation. The next cast could be a slightly longer one, same kind of swing, and then maybe a final one to the distance you can reasonably achieve. For myself, I do like one short cast, one long cast, and if conditions kind of indicated that there was no reason to suspect that there may be more to the spot than I anticipated, I'd move on. You know, the key to being successful fishing on beaches for stripers is your mobility. You want to get locked into one place for a very long time. You know, a 1, 2, 3 cast, a short one followed up with maybe 1 or 2 longer ones with no contact, and you have no other experience with the spot, you know, suggests that you pretty much want to move on.
His question actually was, he says, you're in a place where you see, well, I guess he did say, yeah, do not see striped bass feeding. If you do see fish, so let's turn that around and say, okay, I do see some fish out there. You know, are they always on the bite, or, you know, are you going to fish those fish and find out they're not on the bite and want to move on as well?
Well, I'd submit that if you can see stripers along the shoreline, probably they're feeding on something. Again, remember, the only reason stripers are migrating is simply just that.
Eat, huh?
Eat. And if you see the guy, probably hands down, they are eating. I mean, those female stripers don't get no breaks. They don't get to play. They just have to eat, move, eat some more, and then move some more, and then finally spawn, then move some more and continue to eat.
Bob from Rhode Island asks, he says he has a lot of trouble fishing the surf. He says most of the guys he knows fish estuaries or from rocky areas, but avoid beach fishing. He says, I've tried floating line and intermediate, and that was a disaster when the surf was up, even a little. Should I go to a full sinking line, or what other tips can you give him for fishing the surf?
Breaking surf, probably you want to go with something like a full sink, or better still, like an integrated head type line, and the head would be definitely something that is relatively fast sinking. With a 9-weight rod, you probably want to go with intermediate, a running line, integrated with, say, a 300-350 grain head. You move up to, say, a 10-weight rod, probably want to go, say, 375 up to, say, 475, 500 grains with the head itself. With a cast like that, a head like that with a single hander is not going to, be real conducive to, like, a whole lot of false casting. So you probably want to take a little bit of practice, a little bit of time to get a handle on how to turn that particular head over, you know, relatively quickly with a water load and then shoot forward or with minimum false casting. And again, the objective here is that you don't have to cast initially. Don't think about casting real far. Just get your presentation over the first breaking wave. Most times, the distance-wise, that might be like 60 feet with a single hander. But probably maybe even more practical, consider using a two-hander in that kind of environment. That would help to reduce the overall stress at which your body's working. Plus, you got to remember that the length of a two-hander, it could be up to, practically from, instead of a 9-footer, you're looking at something, typically the rod that I use right now, it's Swedish rod, it's weighted for 8, 9 weights, 12 feet, 4 inches long. I don't even think about that. I think about what the payload that's required to deliver it. But, that gets into a different realm of getting at here. With a simple switch rod, say a two-hander 11 foot long, you got to remember that you're simply releasing the fly at a relatively higher altitude. And just from your basic physics class way back when, you get something that's knocked off with the same force at a higher height, projectile simply going to travel further. So with a two-hander, you always have that height advantage, especially if you're working in surf. It'll definitely work to your advantage there, compared to like a single-hander 9-footer.
We've got a question on the internet here, Peter in New York. He says, I love chasing these guys around Jamaica Bay, but sometimes it's hard to go through the bluefish to get to the stripers. Any tips?
You know, with bluefish,
I guess they're mixed in down there in Jamaica Bay.
Well, you know, the only thing you can do, you really can't avoid bluefish. Bluefish are like a more highly migratory species than stripers, and that they won't persist holding in a particular place in ambush for any particular length of time. The stripers, however, they will persist. I don't know, maybe this is just a function of the length of their lifespan, how the species have developed. How could you, like, avoid bluefish and catch stripers? You might want to find a situation where you have a strong tidal current and you have a distinct structures that are apparent to you, and then fish the structures. And that's one opportunity. As a hedge, just in general as a hedge to like save your flies and stuff, you might want to consider using like a sharp tippet, like a distinctly thicker piece of monofilament line. In place of like a 20 to 15 pound tippet, you'll have like a shock leader there, say 60 pound test, short one that connects the tippet to your fly there. That might help save your flies. But as far as like avoiding bluefish to focus on stripers in like a bay situation like that, it could be a difficult bit.
Yeah, maybe just enjoy. Put that shock tippet on and enjoy the bluefish, huh?
So, I guess. Yeah. Well, why not?
Yeah.
My only question was, oftentimes I have like some of my the flies that I put the most time into. Fly time for me is just flies in general. I don't care what the hell the fly looks like. If you have confidence that the fly that you have on the end of your line, if you have confidence it's going to work, it's going to work for you. I don't care what the heck it looks like. If you're confident it's going to work, you're going to fish it more aggressively. You're going to fish it longer, maybe just the one last cast is finally going to connect for you. To me, like the patterns I'll tie for stripers, I'll put a little bit of work into them. So if bluefish comes up or a school comes up and they just indiscriminately take off with my fly, sometimes they can get kind of pissed off about that. And especially if I tie the fly with a mostly with polar bear here. Gee whiz, recall it 8 years past and being on vacation at the Lower Cape and on Troll and having a polar bear fly stolen from me by a school of a bluefish, simply just going back and getting another fly and with a real stout wire leader and chasing the school down the beach until I finally caught the individual who had my fly in his mouth. it might take many bluefish up on the beach before I finally found one.
That's funny. Well, we're running out of time here. I want to ask you one more question before we close off. Duke, this is from the internet, Duke from Ithaca, I'm assuming maybe Ithaca, New York. He says, and this is a good question for a lot of us that don't live out on the East Coast, what is the best time to visit Massachusetts for striped bass fishing? And on a limited budget, both time and money, what are the best options for fishing for striped bass? So somebody that's traveling to your area, what's the best way to approach that?
Right, the best, probably your best opportunities will occur in the fall. That would be, say, in Massachusetts, somewhere between the first week of September, spanning up to about the third week of October. That's when you probably would have your hands-down best opportunities. Weather-wise, the weather this far north, it takes us a while to warm up. But in terms of temperature-wise, it's early September is a lot like, gee whiz, it's a lot like late July. And in other words, the summer kind of persists a bit longer up this way due to the influence of the ocean. The ocean takes a long time to heat up. But,
It's warm. What about accommodations? Places to stay, any particular areas to stay and fish?
Well, the one thing to consider is like coming out, especially in Massachusetts, like after Labor Day, like after the kids go back to school and so forth, and then you'll find that most housing opportunities, be like a house rental of a condo or an apartment or even a motel room, those rates fall kind of dramatically after Labor Day. And so, again, like after Labor Day and up until the first, second week of October. And believe me, in the lower Cape, this is the very eastern end of it, that the fishing out there can be terrific, even into early and up to Thanksgiving.
Well, is there any particular towns, coastal towns, that you would recommend staying in to be closer to good fishing?
Well, I don't know. My from my own perspective, I'd say Truro at the very lower cape, Wellfleet, East End. Chatham's a terrific, would give you opportunities to fish, you know, the Monomoy Flats complex, where you'd have not only opportunities for, like, a really excellent flats fishing, but also you'll have opportunities to fish, like, a really high-quality open ocean beach along South Beach itself.
Okay, good.
Orleans, East Ham, Chatham, Truro, Wellfleet, and Provincetown.
Okay, good, good. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, Rich. Time flies when you're having fun talking about fishing. And
okay.
But stick with me here, Rich, for a few more minutes. We're going to give away some gifts and give away your book and have some fun with that. So hang tight, everybody. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website at www.familyties.com. That's family and then T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave our website tonight, just take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners for both of our drawings are randomly selected from this show's registration database. If you didn't register already, then it's a little bit late, but make sure you do so for our next show and so you don't miss out on any of the prizes that we do give away. Now, the winners from our drawings will contact you after the show to get your information so that we're able to get you the prizes as well. Now, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, which is a great gift to have. If you want to learn more about what the Federation does and their activities, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. Now, our winner for that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers is Justin Crippen, Justin Crippen in Iowa. So, Justin, enjoy that membership. If you already have one, we'll get that extended for you. So we'll contact you by email and get that coordinated. Now we're going to give away a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and you can learn more about that at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's flyfusionmag.com. Wonderful magazine out of Calgary, Canada, and you'll learn a lot by reading that magazine. And our winner for that is going to be Dennis Jones in Arizona. Dennis Jones. So congratulations, Dennis. And again, we'll be contacting you by email to get your information. So great prize to win, Fly Fusion Magazine. So now, well, the grand prize here, Rich's book, which if you haven't seen his book, you got to go take a look. I mean, this thing is probably at least 10 pounds and wonderful color photography and really everything you'd want to know about fly fishing for stripers. So this is, whoever wins this is really going to be a happy person, I'll tell you that. So, Rich, what we do here is we ask a question about something we talked about during the show, and I'm going to make this real easy tonight, but one of the things that Rich really talked a lot about and kept mentioning again and again is that if you're going to catch a big fish up on Massachusetts and further north, that fish is probably going to be what, a male or a female? Male or a female? So that's an easy one. So who's our winner tonight? Now, well, this is going to be easy enough to, oh, we got Peter in New York City says female. Is he correct, Rich?
Yeah, he's correct.
So that's an easy win, Peter. But sounds like you're in a position that you can go take Rich's book and put it to good use up there on the Eastern Seaboard. So congratulations, Peter. Now, what you need to do is either through that same text box that you just sent the answer is to send me your contact information, first, last name, address, city, state, zip, phone number and email address, so that we can get that book sent out from Wild River Press to you. And thanks again to Wild River Press for providing that book tonight. They've got a bunch of excellent books, and fly fishing for striped bass being one of them. So, Rich, hey, thanks for being on the show tonight. We really appreciate you being on the show, and enjoy talking to you tonight, and hope you enjoyed it, too.
And no sweat. And also, maybe make a plug for Andy Mill. Andy Mill's effort, top of the book, coming up, his interview coming up. That should be
a very interesting one. We've got Andy Mill scheduled for September, and yes, he does have a new book coming out by Wild River.
The book will be available through Wild River Press sometime in July.
And
This should be I'm looking forward to seeing the final version. I've seen draft.
That'll be good. Wild River puts out good books, so I know I'll be impressed. Well, our next broadcast will be on May 19th and at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we're going to be interviewing Dave Blackburn. And our topic for the show will be Kootenai River, Big, Bold, and Beautiful. Dave Blackburn has been fly fishing and guiding the Kootenai River in Montana for over 25 years. If you want to know how to fish and where to fish on this great western trout river, listen in and Dave will share his hard-earned secrets. So we'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska, Keeney's Fly Shop, and Pear Market River Lodge for sponsoring our show tonight. Think your company would benefit from sponsoring our shows? Give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.